achievement all the other ages combined. Learn to fix your attention on a given subject, at will, for whatever length of time you choose, and you will have learned the secret passageway to power and plenty. This is concentration. You will understand from this lesson that the object of forming an alliance between two or more people, and thereby creating a mastermind, is to apply the law of concentration more effectively than it could be applied through the efforts of but one person. The principle referred to as the mastermind is nothing more nor less than a group concentration of mind power upon the attainment of a definite object or end. Greater power comes through group mind concentration because of the stepping up process produced through the reaction of one mind upon another or others. Persuasion versus force. Success has been stated in dozens of different ways throughout this course. It is very largely a matter of tactful and harmonious negotiations with other people. Generally speaking, the man who understands how to get people to do things he wants done may succeed in any calling. As a fitting climax for this lesson on the power of concentration, we shall describe the principles through which men are influenced, through which cooperation is gained, through which antagonism is eliminated and friendliness developed. Force sometimes gets what appears to be big, satisfactory results, but force alone has never built and never can build enduring success. The World War has done more than anything which has happened in the history of the world to show us the futility of force as a means of influencing the human mind. Without going into details or recounting the instances which could be cited, we all know the force was the foundation upon which German philosophy has been built during the past 40 years. The doctrine that might makes right was given a worldwide trial, and it failed. The human body can be imprisoned or controlled by physical force, but it is not so with the human mind. No man on earth can control the mind of a normal, healthy person if that person chooses to exercise his God-given right to control his own mind. The majority of people do not exercise this right. They go through the world, thanks to our faulty educational system, without having discovered the strength which lies dormant in their own minds. Now and then something happens, more in the nature of an accident than anything else, which awakens a person and causes him to discover where his real strength lies and how to use it in the development of industry or one of the professions. Result, a genius is born. There is a given point at which the human mind stops rising or exploring unless something out of the daily routine happens to push it over this obstacle. In some minds, this point is very low, and in others it is very high. In still others, it varies between low and high. The individual who discovers a way to stimulate his mind artificially, arouse it and cause it to go beyond this average stopping point frequently, is sure to be rewarded with fame and fortune if his efforts are of constructive nature. The educator who discovers a way to stimulate any mind and cause it to rise above this average stopping point without any bad reactionary effects, will confer a blessing on the human race, second to none in the history of the world. We, of course, do not have reference to physical stimulants or narcotics. These will always arouse the mind for a time, but eventually they ruin it entirely. We have reference to a purely mental stimulant, such as that which comes through intense interest, desire, enthusiasm, love, etc., the factors out of which a master mind may be developed. The person who makes this discovery will do much towards solving the crime problem. He can do almost anything with a person when they learn how to influence his mind. The mind may be likened to a great field. It is a very fertile field which always produces a crop after the kind of seed which is sown in it. The problem is to learn how to select the right sort of seed and how to sow that seed so that it takes root and grows quickly. We are sowing seeds in our minds daily, hourly, nay, every second, but we are doing it promiscuously and more or less unconsciously. We must learn to do it after a carefully prepared plan, according to a well laid out design. Haphazardly sown seed in the human mind brings back a haphazard crop. There is no escape from this result. History is full of notable cases of men who have been transformed from law-abiding, peaceful, constructive citizens to roving, vicious criminals. We also have thousands of cases wherein men of the low, vicious, so-called criminal type have been transformed into constructive, law-abiding citizens. In every one of these cases, the transformation of the human being took place in the mind of the man. He created in his own mind, for one reason or another, a picture of what he desired, and then proceeded to transform that picture into reality. As a matter of fact, if a picture of any environment, condition, or thing be pictured in the human mind, and if the mind be focused or concentrated on that picture long enough and persistently enough, and backed up by strong desire for the thing pictured, it is but a short step from the picture to the realization of it in physical or mental form. The World War brought out many startling tendencies of the human mind, which corroborate the work with which the psychologist has carried on in his research in the workings of the mind. The following account of a rough, uncouth, unschooled, undisciplined young mountaineer is an excellent case in point. Fought for his religion, now a great war hero. Rotarians planned to present farm to Arvin York, unlettered Tennessee squirrel hunter, by George W. Dixon. How Arvin Cullum York, an unlettered Tennessee squirrel hunter, became the foremost hero of the American expeditionary forces in France, forms a romantic chapter in the history of the World War. York is a native of Fentress County. He was born and reared among the hardy mountaineers of the Tennessee woods. There is not even a railroad in Fentress County. During his earlier years, he was reputed to be a desperate character. He was what was known as a gunman. He was a dead shot with a revolver, and his prowess with the rifle was known far and wide among the plain people of the Tennessee hills. One day, a religious organization pitched its tent in the community in which York and his parents lived. It was a strange sect that came to the mountains looking for converts, but the methods of the evangelistics of the new cult were full of fire and emotionalism. They denounced the sinner, the vile character, and the man who took advantage of his neighbor. They pointed to the religion of the master as an example that all should follow. Alvin gets religion. Alvin Cullum York startled his neighbors one night by flinging himself down at the mourner's bench. Old men stirred in their seats and women craned their necks as York wrestled with his sins in the shadows of the Tennessee mountains. York became an ardent apostle of the new religion. He became an exhorter, a leader in the religious life of the community, and although his marksmanship was as deadly as ever, no one feared him who walked in the path of righteousness. When the news of the war reached that remote section of Tennessee, and the mountaineers were told that they were going to be conscripted, York grew sullen and disagreeable. He didn't believe in killing human beings, even in war. His Bible taught him, "Thou shalt not kill." To his mind, this was literal and final. He was branded as a conscientious objector. The draft officers anticipated trouble. They knew that his mind was made up, and they would have to reach him in some manner other than by threats of punishment. War in a holy cause. They went to York with a Bible and showed him that the war was in a holy cause, the cause of liberty and human freedom. They pointed out that men like himself were called upon by the higher powers to make the world free, to protect innocent women and children from violation, to make life worth living for the poor and oppressed, to overcome the beast pictured in the scriptures, and to make the world free for the development of Christian ideals and Christian manhood and womanhood. It was a fight between the hosts of righteousness and the hordes of Satan. The devil was trying to conquer the world through his chosen agents, the Kaiser and his generals. York's eyes blazed with a fierce light. His big hands closed like a vice. His strong jaws snapped. "The Kaiser," he hissed between his teeth, "the beast, the destroyer of women and children. I'll show him where he belongs if I ever get within gunshot of him." He caressed his rifle, kissed his mother goodbye, and told her he would see her again when the Kaiser had been put out of business. He went to the training camp and drilled with scrupulous care and strict obedience to orders. His skills at target practice attracted attention. His comrades were puzzled at his high scores. They had not reckoned that a backwoods squirrel hunter would make fine material for a sniper in the front-line trenches. York's part in the war is now history. General Pershing has designated him as the foremost individual hero of the war. He won every decoration, including the Congressional Medal, the Croix de Guerre, the Legion of Honor. He faced the Germans without fear of death. He was fighting to vindicate his religion, for the sanctity of the home, the love of women and children, the preservation of the ideals of Christianity, and the liberties of the poor and oppressed. Fear was not in his code or his vocabulary. His coup daring electrified more than 1 million men and set the world to talking about this strange, unlettered hero from the hills of Tennessee. Here we have a case of a young mountaineer who, had he been approached from just a slightly different angle, undoubtedly would have resisted conscription, and likely as not would have become so embittered toward his country that he would have become an outlaw, looking for an opportunity to strike back at the first chance. Those who approached him knew something of the principles through which the human mind works. They knew how to manage young York by first overcoming the resistance that he had worked up in his own mind. This is the very point at which thousands of men, through improper understanding of these principles, are arbitrarily classed as criminals and treated as dangerous, vicious people. Through suggestion, these people could have been handled as effectively as young York was handled, and developed into useful, productive human beings. In your search for ways and means of understanding and manipulating your own mind so you can persuade it to create that which you desire in life, let us remind you that, without a single exception, anything which irritates you and arouses you to anger, hatred, dislike, or cynicism, is destructive and very bad for you. You can never get the maximum or even a fair average of constructive action out of your mind until you have learned to control it and keep it from becoming stimulated through anger or fear. These two negatives, anger and fear, are positively destructive to your mind, and as long as you allow them to remain, you can be sure of results which are unsatisfactory and away below what you are capable of producing. In our discussion of environment and habit, we learned that the individual mind is agreeable to the suggestions of environment, that the minds of individuals of a crowd blend with one another conforming to the suggestion of the prevailing influence of the leader or dominating figure. Mr. J. A. Fisk gives us an interesting account of the influence of mental suggestion in the revival meeting, which bears out the statement that the crowd mind blends into one as follows. Mental suggestion in the revival. Modern psychology has firmly established the fact that the greater part of the phenomena of the religious revival are psychical rather than spiritual in their nature, and abnormally psychical at that. The leading authorities recognize the fact that the mental excitement attendant upon the emotional appeals of the revivalist must be classified with the phenomena of hypnotic suggestion rather than that of true religious experience. And those who have made a close study of the subject believe that instead of such excitement tending to elevate the mind and exalt the spirit of the individual, it serves to weaken and degrade the mind and prostitute the spirit by dragging it into the mud of abnormal psychic frenzy and emotional excess. In fact, by some careful observers familiar with the respective phenomena, the religious revival meeting is classed with the public hypnotic entertainment as a typical example of psychic intoxication and hysterical excess. David Starr Jordan, Chancellor Emeritus of Leland University, says, "Whiskey, cocaine, and alcohol bring temporary insanity, and so does a revival of religion." The late Professor William James of Harvard University, the eminent psychologist, says, "Religious revivalism is more dangerous to the life of society than drunkenness." It should be unnecessary to state that in this lesson the term revival is used in the narrow significant indicating the typical religious emotional excitement known by the term in question, and it is not intended to apply to the older and respected religious experience designated by the same term, which was so highly revered among the Puritans, Lutherans, and others in the past. A standard reference work speaks of the general subject of the revival as follows. Revivals occur in all religions when one takes place a large number of persons who have been comparatively dead or indifferent to spiritual considerations simultaneously or in quick succession become alive to their importance, alter spirituality and morally, and act with exceedingly zeal in converting others to their views. A Mohammedan revival takes the form of a return to the strict doctrines of the Quran and a desire to propagate them by the sword. A Christian minority living in the place is in danger of being massacred by the revivalist. Pentecostal effusion of the Holy Spirit produced a revival within the infant church, followed by numerous conversions from outside. Revivals, though not called by that name, occurred at intervals from apostolic times till the Reformation. The revivalist being sometimes so unsympathetically treated that they left the church and formed sects, while in other cases, and notably in those of the founders of the monastic order, they were retained and acted on the church as a whole. The spiritual impulse which led to the Reformation and the antagonistic one which produced or attended this rise of the Society of Jesus were both revivalists. It is, however, to sudden increase of spiritual activity within the Protestant churches that the term revival is chiefly confined. The enterprise of the Wesleys and the Whitefield in this country in England from 1738 onward was thoroughly revivalist. Since then, various revivals have from time to time occurred, and nearly all denominations aim at their production. The means adopted are prayer for the Holy Spirit, meetings continued night after night, often to a late hour, stirring addresses, chiefly from revivalist laymen, and after meetings to deal with those impressed. Ultimately, it has been found that some of those apparently converted had been steadfast, others had fallen back. While deadness proportioned to the previous excitement temporarily prevails, sometimes excitable persons at revival meetings utter piercing cries or even fall prostrate. These morbid manifestations are now discouraged and have in consequence become more rare. In order to understand the principle of the operation of mental suggestion in the revival meeting, we must first understand something of what is known as the psychology of the crowd. Psychologists are aware that the psychology of a crowd considered as a whole differs materially from that of the separate individuals composing that crowd. There is a crowd of separate individuals and a composite crowd in which the emotional natures of the units seem to blend and fuse. The change from the first-named crowd to the second arises from the influence of earnest attention or deep emotional appeals or common interest. When this change occurs, the crowd becomes a composite individual, the degree of whose intelligent and emotional control is but little above that of its weakest member. This fact, startling as it may appear to the average reader, is well known as admitted by the leading psychologists of the day, and many important essays and books have been written thereupon. The predominant characteristic of this composite-mindedness of a crowd are the evidences of extreme suggestibility, response to appeals of emotion, vivid imagination and action arising from imitation, all of which are mental traits universally manifested by primitive man. In short, the crowd manifests atavism, or reversion to the early racial traits. Dials, in his Psychology of the Aggregate Mind of an Audience, holds that the mind of an assemblage listening to a powerful speaker undergoes a curious process called fusion, by which the individuals in the audience, losing their personal traits for the time being, to a greater or lesser degree, are reduced, as it were, to a single individual, whose characteristics are those of an impulsive youth of 20, imbued in general with high ideals, but lacking in reasoning, power, and will. Tardé, the French psychologist, advances similar views. Professor Joseph Jastrow, in his Fact and Fable in Psychology, says, "In the production of this state of mind, a factor as yet unmentioned plays a leading role, the power of mental contagion. Error, like truth, flourishes in crowds. At the heart of sympathy, each finds a home. No form of contagion is so insidious in its outset, so difficult to check in advance, so certain to leave germs that may at any moment reveal their pernicious power as a mental contagion, the contagion of fear, of panic, of fanaticism, of lawlessness, of superstition, of error. In brief, we must add to the many factors which contribute to deception, the recognized lowering of critical ability, of the power of accurate observation, indeed, of rationality, which merely being one of the crowd induces. The Conjurer finds it easy to perform to a large audience, because, among other reasons, it is easier to arouse their admiration and sympathy, easier to make them forget themselves and enter into the uncritical spirit of Wonderland. It would seem that in some respects the critical tone of the assembly, like the strength of a chain, is that of its weakest member. Professor Le Bon, in his The Crowd, says, "The sentiments and ideas of all the persons in the gathering take one and the same direction, and their conscious personality vanishes. A collective mind is formed, doubtless transitory, by presenting very clearly marked characteristics. The gathering has become what, in the absence of a better expression, I will call an organized crowd, or, if the term be considered preferable, a psychological crowd. It forms a single being, and is subjected to the law of the mental unity of crowds. The most striking peculiarity presented by a psychological crowd is the following. Whoever be the individuals that compose it, however, like or unlike be their mode of life, their occupation, their character, or their intelligence, the fact that they have been transformed into a crowd puts them in possession of a sort of collective mind which makes them feel, think, and act in a manner quite different from that in which each individual of them would feel, think, and act where he is in a state of isolation. There are certain ideas and feelings which do not come into being or do not transform themselves into acts except in the case of the individuals forming a crowd. In crowds, it is stupidity and not mother wit that is accumulated. In the collective mind, the intellectual adepts of the individuals, and in consequence their individuality, is weakened. The most careful observations seem to prove that an individual emerged for some length of time in a crowd in action soon finds himself in a special state, which most resembles the state of fascination, in which the hypnotized individual finds himself. The conscious personality has entirely vanished. Will and discernment are lost. All feelings and thoughts are bent in the direction determined by the hypnotizer. Under the influence of a suggestion, he will undertake the accomplishment of certain acts with irresistible impetuosity. This impetuosity is the more irresistible in the case of crowds, from the fact that, the suggestion being the same for all the individuals of the crowd, it gains in strength by reciprocity. Moreover, by the mere fact that he forms part of an organized crowd, a man descends several rungs in the ladder of civilization. Isolated, he may be a cultured individual. In a crowd, he is a barbarian, that is, a creature acting by instinct. He possesses the spontaneity, the violence, the ferocity, and also the enthusiasm and heroism of primitive beings, whom he further tends to resemble by the faculty with which he allows himself to be induced to commit acts contrary to his most obvious interest and his best-known habits. An individual in a crowd is a grain of sand amid other grains of sand, which the wind stirs up at will. Professor Davenport, in his Primitive Traits in Religious Revival, says, "The mind of the crowd is strangely like that of a primitive man. Most of the people in it may be far from primitive in emotion, in thought, or in character. Nevertheless, the result tends always to be the same. Stimulation immediately begets action. Reason is in abeyance. The cool, rational speaker has little chance beside the skillful emotional orator. The crowd thinks in images, and speech must take this form to be accessible to it. The images are not connected by any natural bond, and they take each other's place like the sides of a magic lantern. It follows from this, of course, that appeals to the imagination have paramount influence. The crowd is united and governed by emotion rather than reason. Emotion is the natural bond, for men differ much less in this respect than in intellect. It is also true that in a crowd of 1,000 men, the amount of emotion actually generated and existing is far greater than the sum which might conceivably be obtained by adding together the emotions of the individuals taken by themselves. The explanation of this is that the attention of the crowd is always directed either by the circumstance of the occasion or by the speaker to certain common ideas, as salvation in religious gatherings, and every individual in the gathering is stirred with emotion, not only because the idea of Shibboleth stirs them, but also because he is conscious that every other individual in the gathering believes in the idea or the shibboleth and is stirred with it, too. And this enormously increases the volume of his own emotion and consequently the total volume of emotion in the crowd. As in the case of the primitive mind, imagination has unlocked the floodgates of emotion, which on occasion may become wild enthusiasm or demonic frenzy. The student of suggestion will see that not only are the emotional members of a revival audience subject to the effect of the composite mindedness arising from the psychology of the crowd, and are thereby weakened in resistive power, but that they are also brought under the influence of two other very potent forms of mental suggestion. Added to the powerful suggestion of authority exercised by the revivalist, which is exerted to the fullest along lines very similar to that of a professional hypnotist, is the suggestion of imitation exerted upon each individual by the combined force of the balance of the crowd. As Durkheim observed in his psychological investigations, the average individual is intimidated by the mass of the crowd around him or before him, and experiences that peculiar psychological influence exerted by the mere number of people as against his individual self. Not only does the suggestible person find it easy to respond to the authoritative suggestions of the preacher and the exhortations of his helper, but he is also brought under the direct fire of the imitative suggestions of those on all sides who are experiencing emotional activities and who are manifesting them outwardly. Not only does the voice of the shepherd urge forward, but the tinkle of the bellwether bell is also heard, and the imitative tendency of the flock, which causes one sheep to jump because one ahead of him does so, and so on until the last sheep has jumped, needs but the force of the example of a leader to start into motion the entire flock. This is not an exaggeration. Human beings in times of panic, fright, or deep emotion of any kind manifest the imitative tendency of the sheep and a tendency of cattle and horses to stampede under imitation. To the student experienced in the experimental work of the psychological laboratory, there is the very closest analogy observed in the respective phenomena of the revival and hypnotic suggestion. In both cases, the attention and interest is attracted by the unusual procedure. The element of mystery and awe is induced by words and actions calculated to inspire them. The senses are tired by monotonous talk in an impressive and authoritative tone. And finally, the suggestions are projected in a commanding, suggestive manner, familiar to all students of hypnotic suggestion. The subject in both cases are prepared for the final suggestions and commands by previously given minor suggestions such as stand up or look this way, etc., in the case of the hypnotist, and by all who think so-and-so stand up and all who are willing to become better stand up, etc., in the case of the revivalist. The impressionable subjects are thus accustomed to obedience to suggestion by easy stages. And finally, the commanding suggestion, come right up this way, right up come, I say come, come, etc., which takes the impressed ones right off their feet and rushes them to the front, are almost precisely the same in the hypnotic experiment or seance on the one hand and the sensational revival on the other. Every good revivalist would make a good hypnotic operator. And every good hypnotic operator would make a good revivalist if his mind were turned in that direction. In the revival, the person giving the suggestions has the advantage of breaking down the resistance of his audience by arousing their sentiments and emotions. Tales depicting the influence of mother, home, and heaven, songs like Tell Mother I'll Be There, and personal appeals to the revered associations of one's past and early life tend to reduce one to the state of emotional response and render him most susceptible to strong, repeated suggestions along the same line. Young people and hysterical women are especially susceptible to this form of emotional suggestion. Their feelings are stirred, and the will is influenced by the preaching, the songs, and the personal appeals of the co-workers of the revivalist. The most sacred sentimental memories are reawakened for the moment, and old conditions of mind are reinduced. Where is my wandering boy tonight? brings forth tears to many a one to whom the memory of the mother is sacred, and the preaching that the mother is dwelling in the state of bliss beyond the skies, from which the unconverted child is cut off unless he professes faith, serves to move many to the action for the time being. The element of fear is also invoked in the revival, not so much as formerly, it is true, but still to the considerable extent and more subtly. The fear of a sudden death in an unconverted condition is held over the audience, and "Why not now? Why not tonight?" is asked him, accompanied by the hymn, "O why do you wait, dear brother?" As Davenport says, "It is well known that the employment of symbolic images immensely increases the emotion of an audience. The vocabulary of revival abounds in them. The cross, the crown, the angel band, hell, heaven. Now vivid imagination and strong feeling and belief are states of mind favorable to suggestion as well as to impulsive action. It is also true that the influence of a crowd largely in sympathy with the ideas suggested is thoroughly coercive or intimidative upon the individual sinner. There is considerable professed conversion which results in the beginning from little more than this form of social pressure, and which may never develop beyond it. Finally, the inhibition of all extraneous ideas is encouraged in revival assemblies, both by prayer and speech. There is, therefore, extreme sensitivity to suggestion. When to these conditions of negative consciousness on the part of an audience there has been added a conductor of the meetings who has a high hypnotic potential, such as Wesley or Finney, or who is only a thoroughly persuasive and magnetic personality, such as Whitefield, there may easily be an influence exerted upon certain individuals of a crowd which closely approaches the abnormal or thoroughly hypnotic. When this point is not reached, there is still a great amount of highly acute, though normal, suggestibility to be reckoned with. The person who shows signs of being influenced are then labored with by either the revivalist or his co-workers. They are urged to surrender their will and leave it all to the Lord. They are told to give yourself to God, now, right now, this minute, or to only believe now and you shall be saved, or won't you give yourself to Jesus, etc. They are exhorted and prayed with, arms are placed around the shoulders, and every art of emotional persuasive suggestion is used to make the sinner give up. Starbuck, in his The Psychology of Religion, relates a number of instances of the experience of converted persons of revivals. One person wrote as follows: "My will seemed wholly at the mercy of others, particularly on the revivalist. There was absolutely no intellectual element. It was pure feeling. There followed a period of ecstasy. I was bent on doing good and was eloquent in appealing to others. The state of moral exaltation did not continue. It was followed by a complete relapse from orthodox religion." Davenport has the following to say in reply to the claim that the old methods of influencing converts at a revival have passed away with the crude theology of the past. "I lay particular stress upon this matter here, because while the employment of irrational fear in revivals has largely passed away, the employment of the hypnotic method has not passed away. There has rather been a recrudescence and a conscious strengthening of it, because the old prop of terror is gone, and it cannot be too vigorously emphasized that such a force is not a spiritual force in any high and clear sense at all, but is rather uncanny and psychic and obscure. And the method itself needs to be greatly refined before it can ever be of any spiritual benefit whatever. It is thoroughly primitive and belongs with the animal and instinctive means of fascination. In this bald, crude form, the feline employs it upon the helpless bird, and the Indian medicine man upon the ghost dance votary. When used, it has often been upon little children who are naturally highly suggestible. It has no justification whatsoever, and is mentally and morally injurious in the highest degree. I do not see how violent emotional throes and the use of suggestion in its crude forms can be made serviceable even in the case of hardened sinners. And certainly, with large classes of the population, the employment of this means is nothing but psychological malpractice. We guard with intelligent care against quackery and physiological obstetrics. It would be well if a sterner training and prohibition hedged against the spiritual obstetrician, whose function it is to guide the far more delicate process of the new birth. Some who favor the methods of the revival, but who also recognize the fact that mental suggestion plays a most important part in the phenomena thereof, hold that the objections similar to those here advanced are not valid against the methods of the revival, inasmuch as mental suggestion, as is well known, may be used for good purposes as well as bad, for the benefit of uplifting of people as well as in the opposite direction. This being admitted, these good folks argue that mental suggestion in the revival is a legitimate method or weapon of attack upon the stronghold of the devil. But this argument is found to be defective when examined in its effects and consequences. In the first place, it would seem to identify the emotional, neurotic, and hysterical mental states induced by revival methods, which the spiritual uplift and moral regeneration, which is the accompaniment of true religious experience. It seeks to place the counterfeit on par with the genuine, the baleful glare of the rays of the psychic moon with the invigorating and animating rays of the spiritual sun. It seeks to raise the hypnotic phase to that of the spiritual mindedness of men. To those who are familiar with the two classes of phenomena, there is a difference as wide as that between the poles existing between them. As a straw showing how the wind of the best modern religious thought is blowing, we submit the following from the volume entitled Religion and Miracle, from the pen of Reverend Dr. George A. Gordon, pastor of the New Old South Church of Boston. For this end, professional revivalism, with its organization, its staff of reporters who make the figures suit the hopes of good men, the system of advertisements, and the exclusion or suppression of all sound critical comment, the appeals to emotion and the use of means which have no visible connection with grace and cannot by any possibility lead to glory, is utterly inadequate. The world waits for the vision, the passion, the simplicity, and the stem truthfulness of the Hebrew prophet. It awaits the imperial breath and moral energy of the Christian apostle to the nations. It awaits the teacher who, like Christ, shall carry his doctrine in a great mind and a great character. While there have undoubtedly been many instances of persons attracted originally by the emotional excitement of the revival, and afterwards leading worthy religious lives in accordance with the higher spiritual nature, still, in too many cases, the revival has exerted but a temporary effect for good upon the persons yielding to the excitement, and after the stress has passed has resulted in creating an indifference and even an aversion for true religious feeling. The reaction is often equal to the original action. The consequences of backsliding are well known in all churches after a spiritual revival. In others, there is merely awakened a susceptibility to emotional excitement, which causes the individual to undergo repeated stages of conversion at each revival, and a subsequent backsliding after the influence of the meeting is withdrawn. Moreover, it is a fact known to psychologists that persons who have given way to the emotional excitement and excesses of the typical revival are rendered afterwards far more suggestible and open to isms, fads, and false religions than before. The people flocking to the support of the various pseudo-religious adventures and impostures of the age are generally found to be the same people who were previously the most ardent and excitable converts of the revival. The ranks of the Messiahs, Elijahs, and prophets of the dawn, who have appeared in great numbers in this country and England during the past 50 years, have been recruited almost exclusively from those who have previously experienced the revival fervor in the Orthodox Church. It is the old story of the training of the hypnotic subject. Especially harmful is this form of emotional intoxication among young people and women. It must be remembered that the period of adolescence is one in which the mental nature of the individual is undergoing great changes. It is a period needed for particular development of the emotional nature, the sex nature, and the religious nature. The existing conditions of this period render the psychic debauchery of the revival, seance, or hypnotic exhibition particularly harmful. Excessive emotional excitement, coupled with mystery, fear, and awe, at this period of life often results in morbid and abnormal conditions arising in afterlife. As Davenport well says, It is no time for the shock of fear or the agony of remorse. The only result of such misguided religious zeal is likely to be a strengthening in many cases of those tendencies, especially in females, toward morbidity and hysteria, toward darkness and doubt. There are other facts connected with the close relation existing between abnormal religious excitement and the undue arousing of the sexual nature, which are all well known to all students of the subject, but which cannot be spoken of here. As a hint, however, the following from Davenport will serve its purpose. At the age of puberty, there is an organic process at work which pushes into activity at nearly the same time the sexual and the spiritual. There is no proof, however, of the causation of the latter by the former, but it does appear to be true that the two are closely associated at the point in the physical process where they branch into different directions. That, at that critical period, any radical excitation of the one has its influence upon the other. A careful consideration of this important statement will serve to explain many things that have surely perplexed many good people in the past, in connection with revival excitement in a town, camp meetings, etc. This apparent influence of the devil, which so worried our forefathers, is seen to be but the operation of natural, psychological, and physiological laws. To understand it is to have the remedy at hand. But what do the authorities say of the revival of the future, the new revival, the real revival? Let Professor Davenport speak for the critics. He is well adapted for the task. He says, "There will be, I believe, far less use of the revival meeting as a crass, coercive instrument for overriding the will and overwhelming the reason of the individual man. The influence of public religious gatherings will be more indirect, more unobtrusive. It will be recognized that hypnotization and forced choices weaken the soul, and there will be no attempt to press the decision in so great a matter under the spell of excitement and contagion and suggestion. The converts may be few, they may be many. They will be measured not by the capacity of the preacher for administrative hypnotism, but rather by the capacity for unselfish friendship of every Christian man and woman. But of this I think we may be confident, the days of religious effervescence and passional unrestraint are dying. The days of intelligent, undemonstrative, and self-sacrificing piety are dawning. To do justly, to love mercy, to walk humbly with God, these remain the cardinal tests of the divine in man. Religious experience is an evolution. We go on from the rudimentary and the primitive to the rational and the spiritual. And believe Paul, the mature fruit of the Spirit is not the subliminal uprush, the lapse of inhibition, but rational love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, meekness, and self-control. The law of concentration is one of the major principles which must be understood and applied intelligently by all who would successfully experiment with the principle described in this course as the mastermind. The foregoing comments by leading authorities of the world will give you a better understanding of the law of concentration as it often used by those who wish to blend or fuse the minds of a crowd, so they will function as a single mind. You are now ready for the lesson on cooperation, which will take you further into the methods of applying the psychological laws upon which this philosophy of success is based. End of lesson. The Law of Success, Lesson 13, Cooperation. You can do it if you believe you can. Cooperation is the beginning of all organized effort, as was stated in the second lesson of this course. Andrew Carnegie accumulated a gigantic fortune through the cooperative efforts of a small group of men numbering not more than a score. You too can learn how to use this principle. There are two forms of cooperation to which your attention will be directed in this lesson, namely, first, the cooperation between people who group themselves together or form alliances for the purpose of attaining a given end under the principles known as the law of the mastermind. Second, the cooperation between the conscious and the subconscious minds, which forms a reasonable hypothesis of man's ability to contact, communicate with, and draw upon infinite intelligence. To one who has not given serious thought to this subject, the foregoing hypothesis may seem unreasonable, but follow the evidence of its soundness and study the facts upon which the hypothesis is based, and then draw your own conclusion. Let us begin with a brief review of the physical construction of the body. We know that the whole body is traversed by a network of nerves which serves as a channel of communication between the indwelling spiritual ego, which we call mind, and the functions of the external organism. This nervous system is dual. One system, known as the sympathetic, is the channel for all those activities which are not consciously directed by our volition, such as the operation of the digestive organs, the repair of the daily wear and tear of the tissues, and the like. The other system, known as the voluntary or cerebral spinal system, is the channel through which we receive conscious perception from the physical senses and exercise control over the movements of the body. This system has its center in the brain, while the other has its center in the ganglionic mass at the back of the stomach, known as the solar plexus, and sometimes spoken of as the abdominal brain. The cerebrospinal system is a channel of our volitional or conscious mental action, and the sympathetic system is a channel of that mental action which unconsciously supports the vital functions of the body. Thus, the cerebrospinal system is the organ of the conscious mind, and the sympathetic is that of the subconscious mind. But the interaction of conscious and subconscious minds requires a similar interaction between the corresponding systems of nerves, and one conspicuous connection by which this is provided is the vagus nerve. The nerve passes out of the cerebral region as a portion of the voluntary system, and through it we control the vocal organs. Then it passes onward to the thorax, sending out branches to the heart and lungs, and finally passing through the diaphragm. It loses the outer coating, which distinguishes the nerves of the voluntary system, and becomes identified with those of the sympathetic system, so forming a connecting link between the two, and making the man physically a single entity. Similarly, different areas of the brain indicate their connection with the objective and subjective activities of the mind respectively, and speaking in a general way, we may assign the frontal portion of the brain to the former, and the posterior portion to the latter, while the intermediate portion partakes of the character of both. The intuitional faculty has its correspondence in the upper area of the brain, situated between the frontal and the posterior portions, and physiologically speaking, it is here the intuitive ideas find entrance. These at first are more or less unformed and generalized in character, but are nevertheless perceived by the conscious mind. Otherwise, we should not be aware of them at all. Then the effort of nature is to bring these ideas into more definite and usable shape. So the conscious mind lays hold of them and induces a corresponding vibratory current in the voluntary system of nerves. And this in turn induces a similar current in the involuntary system, thus handing the idea over to the subjective mind. The vibratory current, which had first descended from the apex of the brain to the frontal brain and thus through the voluntary system to the solar plexus, is now reversed and ascends from the solar plexus through the sympathetic system to the posterior brain. This return current indicating the action of subjective mind. If we were to remove the surface portion of the apex of the brain, we should find immediate below it the shining belt of brain substance called the corpus callus. This is the point of union between the subjective and the objective. And as the current returns from the solar plexus to this point, it is restored to the objective portion of the brain in a fresh form, which it has acquired by the silent alchemy of the subjective mind. Thus the conception, which was at first only vaguely recognized, is restored to the objective mind in a definite and workable form. And then the objective mind, acting through the frontal brain, the area of comparison and analysis, proceeds to work upon clearly perceived idea, and to bring out the potentialities that are latent in it. The term subjective mind is the same as the term subconscious mind, and the term objective mind is the same as conscious mind. Please understand these different terms. By studying this dual system through which the body transmits energy, we discover the exact points at which the two systems are connected, and the manner in which we may transmit a thought from the conscious to the subconscious mind. This cooperative, dual nervous system is the most important form of cooperation known to man. For it is through the aid of this system that the principle of evolution carries on its work of developing accurate thought, as described in Lesson 11. When you impress any idea on your subconscious mind through the principle of autosuggestion, you do so with the aid of this dual nervous system. And when your subconscious mind works out a definite plan of any desire with which you impress on it, the plan is delivered back to your conscious mind through this same dual nervous system. This cooperative system of nerves literally constitutes a direct line of communication between your ordinary conscious mind and infinite intelligence. Knowing from my own previous experience as a beginner in the study of this subject how difficult it is to accept the hypothesis here described, I will illustrate the soundness of the hypothesis in a simple way that you can both understand and demonstrate for yourself. Before going to sleep at night, impress upon your mind the desire to arise the next morning at a given hour, say at 4 a.m., and if your impression is accompanied by a positive determination to arise at that hour, your subconscious mind will register the impression and awaken you at precisely that time. Now the question might well be asked, if I ran and impressed my subconscious mind with a desire to arise at a specific time, and it will awaken me at that time, why do I not form the habit of impressing it with other and more important desires? If you will ask yourself this question and insist upon an answer, you will find yourself very near, if not on the pathway that leads to the secret door to knowledge, as described in Lesson 11. We will now take up the subject of cooperation between men who unite or group themselves together for the purpose of attaining a given end. In the second lesson of this course, we refer to this sort of cooperation as organized effort. We are living in an age of cooperative effort. Nearly all successful businesses are conducted under some form of cooperation. The same is true in the field of industry and finance, as well as in the professional field. Doctors and lawyers have their alliances for mutual aid and protection in the form of bar associations and medical associations. The bankers have both local and national associations for their mutual aid and advancement. The retail merchants have their associations for the same purpose. The automobile associations have groups themselves. The printers have their associations. The plumbers have theirs, and coal dealers have theirs also. Cooperation is the object of all of these associations. The laboring men have their unions, and those who supply the working capital and superintend the efforts of laboring men have their alliances under various names. Nations have their cooperative alliances, although they do not appear to have yet discovered the full meaning of cooperation. The attempt of the late President Wilson to perfect the League of Nations, followed by the efforts of the late President Harding to perfect the same idea under the name of the World Court, indicates the trend of the times in the direction of cooperation. It is slowly becoming obvious to man that those who most efficiently apply the principle of cooperative effort survive the longest, and that this principle applies from the lowest form of animal life to the highest form of human endeavor. Mr. Carnegie and Mr. Rockefeller and Mr. Ford have taught the businessman the value of cooperative effort. That is, they have taught all who cared to observe the principle through which they accumulated vast fortunes. Cooperation is the very foundation of all successful leadership. Henry Ford's most tangible asset is the well-organized agency force that he has established. This organization not only provides him with an outlet for all the automobiles he can manufacture, but of greater importance still, it provides him with financial power sufficient to meet any emergency that may arise, a fact which he has already demonstrated on at least one occasion. As a result of his understanding of the value of the cooperative principle, Ford has removed himself from the usual position of dependence upon financial institutions, and at the same time provided himself with more commercial power than he could possibly use. The Federal Reserve Bank system is another example of cooperative effort which practically insures the United States against a money panic. The chain source systems constitute another form of commercial cooperation that provides advantage through both the purchasing and the distributing end of the business. The modern department store, which is the equivalent of a group of small stores operating under one roof, one management, and one overhead expense, is another illustration of the advantage of cooperative effort in the commercial field. In Lesson 15, you will observe the possibilities of cooperative effort in its highest form, and at the same time you will see the important part that it plays in the development of power. As you have already learned, power is organized effort. The three most important factors that enter into the process of organizing effort are concentration, cooperation, and coordination. How power is developed through cooperation. As we have already seen, power is organized effort of energy. Personal power is developed by developing, organizing, and coordinating the faculties of the mind. This may be accomplished by mastering and applying the 15 major principles upon which this course is founded. The necessary procedure through which these principles may be mastered is thoroughly described in the 16th lesson. The development of personal power is but the first step to be taken in the development of the potential power that is available through the medium of allied effort or cooperation, which may be called group power. It is a well-known fact that all men who have amassed large fortunes have been known as able organizers. By this is meant that they have possessed the ability to enlist the cooperative efforts of other men who supplied talent and ability which they themselves did not possess. The chief object of this course is so to unfold the principles of organized and cooperative or allied effort that the student will comprehend their significance and make them the basis of this philosophy. Take it as an example, any business or profession that you choose, and you will observe by analysis that it is limited only by lack of application of organized and cooperative effort. As an illustration, consider the legal profession. If a law firm consists of but one type of mind, it will be greatly handicapped, even though it may be made up of a dozen able men of this particular type. The complicated legal system calls for a greater variety of talent than any one man could possibly provide. It is evident, therefore, that mere organized effort is not sufficient to ensure outstanding success. The organization must consist of individuals, each of whom supplies some specialized talent which the other members of the organization do not possess. A well-organized law firm would include talent that was specialized in the preparation of cases, men of vision and imagination who understand how to harmonize the law and the evidence of a case under a sound plan. Men who have such ability are not always possessed of the ability to try a case in court. Therefore, men who are proficient in court procedure must be available. Carrying the analysis a step further, it will be seen that there are many different classes of cases which call for men of various types of specialized ability in both the preparation and the trial of these cases. A lawyer who had prepared himself as a specialist in corporation law might be wholly unprepared to handle a case in criminal procedure. In forming a law partnership, the man who understood the principles of organized cooperative effort would surround himself with talent that was specialized in every branch of law and legal procedure in which he intended to practice. The man who had no conception of the potential power of these principles would probably select his associates by the usual hit-or-miss method, basing his selections more upon personality or acquaintanceship than consideration of the particular type of legal talent that each possessed. The subject of organized effort has been covered in the preceding lessons of this course, but it is again brought up in connection with this lesson for the purpose of indicating the necessity of forming alliances or organizations consisting of individuals who supply all the necessary talent that may be needed for the attainment of the object in mind. In nearly all commercial undertakings, there is a need for at least three classes of talent, namely buyers, salesmen, and those who are familiar with finance. It will be readily seen that when these three classes of men organize and coordinate their efforts, they avail themselves through this form of cooperation of power, which no single individual in the group possesses. Many a business fails because of all the men back of it are salesmen, or financial men, or buyers. By nature, the most able salesmen are optimistic, enthusiastic, and emotional, while able financial men, as a rule, are unemotional, deliberate, and conservative. Both classes are essential to the success of a commercial enterprise, but either class will prove too much of a load for any business without the modifying influence of the other class. It is generally conceded that James J. Hill was the most efficient railroad builder that America ever produced, but it is equally well known that he was not a civil engineer, nor a bridge builder, nor a locomotive engineer, nor a mechanical engineer, nor a chemist, although these highly specialized classes of talent are essential in railroad building. Mr. Hill understood the principles of organized effort and cooperation. Therefore, he surrounded himself with men who possessed all this necessary ability which he lacked. The modern department store is a splendid example of organized cooperative effort. Each merchandising department is under the management of one who understands the purchasing and marketing of the goods carried in that specific department. Back of all these department managers is a general staff consisting of specialists in buying, selling, financing, and the management of units or groups of people. This form of organized effort places back of each department both buying and selling power, such as that department could not afford if it were separated from the group and had to be operated under its own overhead in a separate location. The United States of America is one of the richest and most powerful nations of the world. Upon analysis, it will be seen that this enormous power has grown out of the cooperative efforts of the states of the Union. It was for the purpose of saving this power that the immortal Lincoln made up his mind to erase the Mason-Dixon line. The savings of the Union was a far greater concern to him than was the freedom of the slaves of the South. Had this not been so, the present status of the United States as a power among the nations of the world would be far different from what it is. It was the same principle of cooperative effort that Woodrow Wilson had in mind when he created his plan for a League of Nations. He foresaw the need of such a plan as a medium for preventing war between nations, just as Lincoln foresaw it as a medium for harmonizing the efforts of the people of the United States, thereby preserving the Union. Thus it is seen that the principle of organized cooperative effort, through the aid of which the individual may develop personal power, is the self-same principle that must be employed in developing group power. Andrew Carnegie easily dominated the steel business during his active connection with the industry, for the reason that he took advantage of the principle of organized cooperative effort by surrounding himself with highly specialized financial men, chemists, sales managers, buyers of raw materials, transportation experts, and others whose services were essential to that industry. He organized this group of cooperators into what he called a mastermind. Any great university affords an excellent example of the necessity of organized cooperative effort. The professorate is made up of men and women of highly specialized, though vastly different ability. One department is provided over by experts in literature, another department by experts in mathematics, another in chemistry, another in economic philosophy, and another in medicine. The university as a whole is the equivalent of a group of colleges, each of which is directed by experts in its own line, whose efficiency is greatly increased through allied or cooperative effort that is directed by a single head. Analyze power, no matter where or in what form it may be found, and you will find organization and cooperation as the chief factors back of it. You will find these two principles in evidence in the lowest form of vegetation, no less than in the highest form of animal, which is man. Off of the coast of Norway is the most famous and irresistible maelstrom in the world. This great whirlpool of ceaseless motion has never been known to give up any victim who was caught in its circling embrace of foaming water. No less sure of destruction are those unfortunate souls who are caught in the great maelstrom of life, toward which all who do not understand the principle of organized cooperative efforts are traveling. We are living in a world in which the law of the survival of the fittest is everywhere in evidence. Those who are fit are those who have power, and power is organized effort. Unfortunate is the person who either through ignorance or because of egotism imagines that he can sail this ship of life in the frail bark of independence. Such a person will discover that there are maelstroms more dangerous than any mere whirlpool of unfriendly waters. All natural laws and all nature's plans are based upon harmonious, cooperative effort, as all who have attained high places in the world have discovered. Wherever people are engaged in unfriendly combat, no matter what may be its nature or its cause, one may observe the near